Okay, welcome to episode 43 of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast. We are starting off our episode today with some predictions around what's going to happen with the office market. There's very wide consensus in the betting markets that there's going to be a cut from the Federal Reserve on interest rates in September. We are recording here in the very, very end of August. And a lot of people are touting that as, hey, we've rounded the corner for office space. Maybe interest rates are going to come down by enough that we don't see as widespread defaults as some people are predicting. So we're using this as an opportunity to talk about, similarly to what we did in one of our prior episodes on industrial, about office space. What's going to happen? Are we going to turn that corner? What's going to happen in the space market? But then also, what's going to happen with these massive commercial real estate debt figures? Are they going to be worked out? Are there going to be defaults still? What happens? So anyways, John, I know you were eager to share some of your thoughts first and some articles that you'd sent around to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got three articles. I'll try and be brief on all three and leave it for the group to discuss. Two are of a negative nature. One is of a positive nature, and we can discuss the merits of each. I'll start with this article from Bloomberg. It hits on something that we've been talking about on the pod for a long time. I think really before it became a thing, this idea that urban centers, the shifting, metropolitan centers are changing. The whole civic design is going to change in response to what we learned through the pandemic and some form of hybrid work and where people go to work and why they go to work. So it's a long article. I'll just hit some of the headlines. $555.7 billion drop in office values eclipses a revival of cities. A subheadline: commercial real estate turmoil is centered mostly on aging central business districts, with outer neighborhoods holding up better or even thriving. It compares the Avenue of the Stars with downtown LA 10 miles away. Here's a paragraph. It's a key to understanding the turmoil rocking the U.S. commercial property market, where big landlords, including Brookfield, Blackstone, and Starwood Capital Group, have walked away from older downtown towers, and foreign investors from South Korea to Germany have been burned by bad bets. On what was once seen as a safe, high-yielding investment. Office values in U.S. central business districts have plunged 52% from their highs, according to MSCI, with San Francisco, Manhattan, and the core areas of Washington and Boston posting some of the biggest price declines among global metropolises. These are since the pandemic. Okay, a little bit more, and then I'll stop. The drop in values from the peak is smaller, 18%. It's what happens with averages. Companies trying to get employees back to their desks are instead paying top dollar for addresses in low-crime neighborhoods with nearby parks, fitness centers, shopping, restaurants, and entertainment. That's creating a paradox of high vacancy rates in many markets, yet not enough of the type of space that tenants want. One more and then I'll stop. About $557 billion of value erased U.S. markets in 2019 through 2023. Because of falling demand, older, low-quality properties disproportionately affected, according to an estimate by economists at Columbia and New York University. At the same time, only 2% of the country's office buildings are considered to be top tier, not the 6% you mentioned, Brian. These folks are looking at the top 2%, A++ maybe. Only 2% of the country's office buildings are considered to be top tier, and they charge rents that are average 84% more than the rest of the market. I'll stop there. It makes comparisons in Boston, Seaport to downtown financial. It makes comparisons of Seattle to Bellevue. Is that fair? It mentions East Loop, West Loop in Chicago. But so is it happening? I mean, we're giving up these downtown centers. Is that a fair assessment? And isn't it interesting that languishing markets while other areas are thriving? And I love the comment that, not enough of the type of space that tenants actually want exists. Your thoughts?
Some of the examples in here are really interesting, where it talks about downtown LA versus Century City. It talks about Seattle versus Bellevue. And I almost wonder if it's more of a governance thing than it is actually leaving these urban cores. Because if you ask people that live in Los Angeles, no one would tell you that Century City is suburban in any way, right? It's, 10 plus million square foot, super dense office market that's comprised of mostly, 30 plus story buildings immediately adjacent to Beverly Hills, kind of in between Beverly Hills and Santa Monica-ish. It's very urban. Basically, 100% of the population would consider it a city. Yet, it's performing way better and it's very safe. There's no homelessness. The mall in Century City is beautiful and really well taken care of and just had a huge upgrade. It's a pretty happening spot to be. And the same is true in Bellevue. And it really makes you wonder, is it this departure from urban cores to get closer to where people live, which is not true. I mean, you can weigh in on this in Seattle, Bellevue, but that's not really true in Century City. It's not necessarily closer to where people live, depending on where your workforce is coming from. I think it has way more to do with safety and crime sort of pulling these areas into places where people don't want to work.
I couldn't agree more. And I'll also add that, you know, there's, John, that article, you said there's a lack of availability for the space that people want. And I would strongly disagree with that as well. Well, certainly, that class A++ type of office space that you're referring to might have limited supply relative to the broader commodity office market. At least in the markets that I've worked in this year, or throughout the country for that matter, there's still plenty of supply, even the plus-plus buildings. Now, they might be trading at higher prices. There might be less availability than the class B buildings or the A- commodity buildings, but there's certainly no shortage is my suggestion. There are certainly some buildings that are very well stabilized, much to the fact that they were fully stabilized or near stabilized even before the pandemic, locked in with long 10 to 15 year leases. But yeah, I would say on those two points, those are my assessments. In Bellevue, like Tucker said, is definitely not considered to be a suburban market. In fact, I think that might be offensive to those that call Bellevue home to call them suburbia. But much like Century City, Bellevue's a lot different than Seattle in terms of the ecosystem and what it's like to be there, what it's like to go to lunch, to get a coffee, to go shopping. All the things that Tucker mentioned, you know, are akin to Century City are very similar to Bellevue, where high-end shopping, no homelessness, very safe neighborhoods. So there might be a flight to quality that's driving, that's being driven rather by certain factors, such as like, you know, safety, but I don't think it's a supply-driven issue.
I know we were talking a little bit about the report that came out on the 12 biggest office markets in the U.S. Why don't you talk to us about that? And then let's loop Brian into this. Let's hear what Brian thinks about where the office market is going. I can tell he's sitting over there. He hasn't said anything yet. He looks eager. He wants to get involved. Let's loop him in.
All right. Well, I'll launch this and we'll see what he has to say. Yeah, there's an article that came out on Globe Street, which is a commercial real estate online publication. And the report was that there are 12 biggest markets in the country over the first 6 months of 2024 are actually seeing an increase in their net effective rents for the Class A plus or plus plus buildings in those markets. Whereas the commodity buildings, call it A minus and B and C, are seeing further decreases. So the bifurcation between those buildings that, John, to your point, people want to be in and those buildings that people don't want to be in is getting greater by the day. And frankly, just driven by the fact that there's not as much demand as there once was previous to the pandemic. And those that do need office space are demanding higher quality spaces. So the data suggests that those landlords that own the premium properties are actually starting to be able to increase their effective rents.
Thanks for tapping me in, Tucker. Really appreciate joining the conversation. To your point, Owen, I saw a recent study that 60% of companies are, or 60% of the companies that responded to a recent survey are considering relocating their office to a higher quality building in location, right? So, certainly, if you have that level of demand towards that premium product, you're going to be able to charge a premium. You know, Boston is unique in the sense that the market they referenced in that article, the Seaport, if you're under 20,000 square feet, you have probably zero options. And that's, you know, it's a couple of months old of doing a survey for a tenant down there. If you are over 20,000 feet and you're a full floor office user, you have four or five options, maybe six. But it's a market that was built over the last 10 or 15 years by single tenant or anchor tenant led office development. So it's the big users that are there. and there's not a lot of buildings that are broken up to support where most companies are. I think the last time I saw our data, the average tenant in Boston was 7,500 square feet, right? But so this market, while that article is probably accurate, there's just not a lot of product that's been broken up to support the average tenant size. So it feels full, but there's still a lot of either sublease or sublease slash direct that's coming back to owners that can support the larger users in every market. Now, I tell you, in the downtown market, there's two or three brand new buildings that have seen strong leasing. They're not full yet. But one of them just delivered, one of them will deliver next year. They're in subprime locations, but still seeing strong demand. Why? Because they're brand new and everything around them is 20, 30, 40 years old. And back to Owen's point, companies don't want to be there. They'll pay the premium on a face rent, but they will take less space to be in that high quality activated, environment that their people want and require. You can walk from most buildings in the financial district or a downtown. You can walk to the Seaport or the Back Bay, right? So if you're a $50 or $60 rent in the downtown and you're $75 in the Seaport or $75 or $80 in the Back Bay, it at times could be treated as one market. At a higher level. Now, if you get into the level where your people live and work people live and want to be, it's the Back Bay or the Seaport. But I think the article's a little misleading just based on the current dynamics in the marketplace.
So here's something I notice, and I wonder what you all think. Isn't it interesting? We've talked about it before, but the best buildings aren't just the best buildings. They're also in the best locations, and to separate those two things. And before I do that, I would say for baseline, this idea that you're safe, you know, homelessness, encampments on the sidewalks, that's sort of the image in mind I have for downtown LA right now. Like, that's table stakes. That has to be solved. Nobody wants to walk past homeless people into their office building. So I think as long as that exists, the leasing is going to be flat and suffer. So let's solve that, right? If only on a humanitarian basis, let's figure out how to solve that. But it's got to be safe.
John, just pause there. Like, realistically, I think we're going to see another moonwalk before we solve the homelessness crisis in the country. And that's not to say I don't want to. Reality is it's not going to get solved in our careers, probably. It's something that's going in the other direction, and it would take massive changes on a local, state, and federal level with governments that historically don't make those big changes. And I don't even know if there's a solution that they can think of to make those changes. So what that means is that you're going to have to live with it. And people are making decisions to move to Century City because they don't have to deal with it. And you may see that area rise. And the ones that unfortunately are dealing with that type of homelessness are going to suffer. And I think they'll continue to suffer. That's my opinion.
Besides the work that our elected officials need to do to help curb the homeless crisis, it also takes occupancy. So this is a double-edged sword. You know, I say it takes occupancy, it takes people invested in their community. And so one of the reasons Seattle got so bad, besides other factors, which we won't get into, is that everybody left downtown. And I don't mean everybody in its absolute form, but a lot of people went to work from home. Well, when you don't have a downtown supported by occupancy, you don't have retailers. And so all the retail gets shuttered. You lack the vibrancy. And so either you're a downtown that has invested in multifamily, so you have people invested in their community, they care about what's going on their doorstep vis-a-vis the sidewalk, or you don't. And if you don't, like the case of downtown Seattle, at least the CBD, the Central Business District, that's a big reason why that market still has a bunch of homelessness, because we don't have people that are invested in that community 24/7. Now, that's not to suggest for those that are listening that Belltown or South Lake Union, which does have a lot of multifamily and 24/7 kind of occupancy, isn't the same as downtown. I'm suggesting the two are two totally different, because you walk around South Lake Union and while you may see someone that's homeless, you don't see the abundance of it that you do see downtown. But I guess my point is, guys, is that it's not just a policy driven issue. This is a matter of people coming back, and with this with this flight to quality, like you're talking about Century City or Bellevue, if that's where the demand's going to end up going or continues to go in some regard, or to what is the true suburbs, which weren't named in the article you kicked off this pod with, John, these downtowns have a long road of recovery. And so I'm speaking for the A, the B, and the C buildings, obviously not suggesting that the A plus will face the same demise, but potentially.
And so what I would say is, and first of all, I hope there is a solution to the homelessness problem. I hope we try things. I hope we explore. I want to be more optimistic that there's a solution there just from a humanitarian perspective. And beyond that, this idea, let's use Boston and the financial district. If you owned an older building in the financial district in Boston, it isn't enough to simply invest in the building and then you're an A-plus property. You're never going to be the live, work, play environment that the Back Bay is. And therefore, should you invest significant capital to upgrade your building to try and compete with that group, I would say the answer is probably yes. And the rents have got to come down. Like, that's the osmosis, that rents will fall until the spread is big enough where it can't be ignored. And for those companies that the difference is material, they may choose to go to the financial district. But isn't that interesting to notice that just spending capital on the building isn't enough? It's got to be spending capital and lowering rents to try and compete because you don't have the location.
Rents have fallen in Seattle precipitously, like extreme compared to Bellevue, okay? And there were times, even now in some cases, where someone can pay 20, 25, as much as 30% less to be in downtown Seattle than to a comparable building in Bellevue potentially. And that still hasn't tipped the scale. And so I guess the question that I don't have the answer for is, at what point does it become so cheap that you decide to make a sacrifice for location for financial savings? And I don't know if there is a number, John, because if it's not something that people can encourage your team to come back to, there's no price, right? Like I just don't think there's a price that someone would pay to have office space that could potentially have a huge detriment to the team.
I mean, look, I think the market will discover a price, to John's point, where the delta is worth it. But I think in many instances, before the market discovers what that price is, there's going to be another market reaction from the owners in whatever city we're talking about, in this case, Seattle compared to Bellevue, where they say, the reason we are not competitive is not because of economics, it's because of something else. And we need to change our governance in order to fix this. Otherwise, structurally, we never can compete and our investments are going to fail. I personally think that the market discovery on, hey, we need to change what's important to us as a community in order to increase safety, I think that that happens in basically every city way before the very sticky pricing of commercial real estate assets ever falls far enough that there's actually a decision to be made. Because Owen, to your point, I agree with you. I think it's very hard for someone to go to a location that they are not proud of or that doesn't align with sort of their vision for how their company occupies office space, regardless of price. But to John's point, I think that if it were 70% cheaper, which is never going to happen, but if it were, that they probably go look at it and they probably come up with some other way saying, okay, we can pay everyone more. We can, you know, hire a personal security guard to walk with every employee whenever they leave the building into their car. Like, there's so much things you can do when the market savings is that enormous. But yeah, Brian, I know you wanted to jump in and say something.
Yeah, I just want to give you an example, right? So I have a proposal right now for a Class B building in Boston in the financial district. It's a $40 gross rent. So tax and operating, say $15 to $20. Let's say it's $20, just to be round numbers. So that's a $20 net rent. They're willing to give 12 months of free rent. So that's another $8 a foot, right, per year. And then $50 to $60 in TI that you can credit 100% back to rent if you want. This is for a renewal. So that's a $20 net rent. Take $10 a foot for TI. You could probably get it to 60 if you want. So that's that gets you down to $10. Then you got $8 in free rent. You have a $2 net deal. Like, how much further can, and the clients aren't going to go there. Like, they don't want to be in the building.
And the $2 is annual, by the way.
$2 is annual. Right. and they don't want to be in the building. It's probably 50% vacant. So how much further can the market fall in a city where these buildings are just too old? Like, you're going to invest in that building? No way. No bank or investor is going to allow you to spend a nickel reinvesting into that building. You're effectively out of the money just by carrying that vacancy. So that's the problem with these buildings. It isn't a market negotiation. It's how low can I go and to actually want to do a deal with you? And if I don't, why don't I just give the building back, right? And right now, they don't have to give the buildings back because the lenders are saying, as long as you can pay me something, keep the building and see what happens. So I don't think the market is going to correct until two things either happen. These buildings go back to lenders and the basis is reset down. So you can make money on a $40 deal, right? Or they're just taken out of inventory and there's an artificial demand change, similar to what happened in the suburbs around Boston. Supply change, where about 5 or 6% of the inventory in the North Market came out of inventory when they wanted to convert it to life sciences. So you had a 13% vacancy rate drop to single digits. And that immediately made the buildings that are still in the office sector more valuable because there's just less of them. So until we see either that happen in a market like Boston with these class B, A minus B buildings, or them all just going back into receivership and new owners with much lower basis, I don't really see the market recovering because no one even wants to go to the building at those numbers, right? But if they own it at $100 a foot, maybe they will invest in it to get a $50 rent.
It occurs to me that we should pay attention as we go forward to when we refer to things like the office market, because that, you know, the risk of averages is not telling the story. There are so many subtle distinctions, some not so subtle, between the best and the rest, that anytime we're talking about like a national vacancy rate, it's just really distorting the true story that's happening underneath in the specifics. If you will, I'll pivot to my second article of three. This one, again, is a negative news story. My last one's positive. This one's from CoStar. Just a couple quick headlines. Major banks report surge in non-current commercial real estate loans. Regulators take notice of growing amount of financing behind in payments, notably office lending. Okay, so that, you know, interest rate reductions are coming up. Are we at the bottom of the market? We're going to come out of this thing. What does this tell us? And by the way, there's a great visual for all of you that tune in and actually look at the watch us on the pod. Across the country, higher office vacancies are doing more than cutting into the net operating income of building owners. They're also pushing higher the percentage of loans that are either 90 plus days behind on payments or have been earmarked for the lender to collect less than the full principal and interest due. Taken together, this non-current loan rate now stands at 4.5%, the highest since the fourth quarter of 2013. One more paragraph. The relentless wave of negative net absorption, in which more tenants leave than move in, has pushed office vacancy rates to unprecedented levels with no sight of relief this year. In 2010, the national office vacancy rate peaked at just over 14%, then slowly erased 2 percentage points over the next decade. But today's post-pandemic reality is more acute. Vacancy rates have surged to 20%, dragging non-current loan rates with it. What do you think?
So I think we've talked a lot about this. This is the perspective I want to talk about. A week ago today, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics revised the jobs report down by 818,000 jobs, right? So the labor markets are much weaker than people, I think, expected them to be or have been told they are. I think the biggest driver in my mind of the weakness in the office market is employees working from home, right? And if we take the working from home out of the equation, what has changed real estate cycles in the past? It's the jobs market, right? And if you have people working from home in a weak job market, even if interest rates start to drop, if the demand's not there because companies aren't taking more space, I don't think any of this goes away. I think it's going to continue to get worse for owners. I think a, you know, 100 basis points or 25 basis point reduction in rates is going to be too little too late, as I think you said earlier, Owen. And it's not going to matter because demand is really, really slowing if we take these as a trend that's materializing right now.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate. I'm not sure that this is true, but historically, pre-pandemic, the jobs market was very correlated to office occupancy and what you'd see absorption for the next quarter. And that was widely known, that whatever the jobs numbers are doing is probably what's going to happen next quarter or next, you know, half year in the corporate real estate world for office space. What if now it's actually an inverse correlation? A bad jobs report actually means that office space is going to perform better because employers have more power to force their people to come back, and they can't readily change occupation, change careers, jobs as easily as they could before. When we talk to the companies that we work with and talk to founders and people running companies, almost universally, everyone wants their people to be in the office and be more engaged. Like almost universally. And the reason that they aren't is fear of people leaving and getting another job. Many people have said, this is not the hill I'm going to die on. I'm not going to have my team churn and quit over forcing them back to the office. But if that fear of no longer having people quit or churn because they're most likely not going to be able to get another job, or they're willing to make that bet that they're not going to try and get another job, then people are coming back to the office. And yeah, maybe unemployment goes up by a couple of percentage points if we continue to have bad jobs numbers. But if we had 100% or 90% of people that used to work in an office space now working in an office space again, that would be way better for the office market, even if unemployment continues to tick up.
You touched on a good point here. And I think it was John, you started it with interest rates, and Brian, you too, suggesting it's not going to make that big of a difference. It might be too little too late. I agree with all of that. But in addition to a negative jobs report, let's say on the 18th, or is it the 17th, whenever Jerome has their Fed meeting, I think it's the 2 days, the 17th and the 18th. Let's say they do drop interest rates by 50 basis points. I mean, Jamie Dimon suggested it was going to be dropped by 100 by the end of the year, but let's just say this first cut is 50 basis points. That's obviously going to reduce borrowing costs, might end up spurring a little bit of activity in the commercial real estate market. But I think the impact here that our listeners care about, because again, we're serving the tenant, not necessarily the landlord, is what's that going to mean to me? And how might that improve the world that I live in, which is the office or industrial market, whatever type of product you might lease. And I think by and large, it could have a positive effect, especially if, to Tucker's point, a negative jobs report encourages people to come back, because you could have improved operating costs with lower refinancing costs with the asset, because I'm doing transactions right now where we're struggling to find a way to make a deal because lenders' restrictions on what the landlord can and can't do is making it prohibitively challenging to get deals done. And so if property owners are able to refinance, they might be able to do deals that are, you know, more in line with what market should be. And maybe it even gives some the reason to reinvest in their properties. You know, we talked, 10 minutes ago about, you know, properties trying to elevate themselves in their stature in terms of, you know, class A to A plus. Well, maybe if borrowing costs are lower, less expensive, we see some sort of increase in reinvestment in these assets. And so I want to make one more point on the jobs. You know, all of us on this pod right now work in markets that have pretty strong labor statistics. Okay. I'm, you know, joining this pod this week from far northern Michigan. You know, some might call it a quote flyover state, but the economy here driving around is a lot different than that which you would see in Seattle. And I think we need to remember that a big chunk of our country is not these coastal cities where people are paid extremely well, where unemployment is extremely low. I'm starting to see, just driving around, you know, what the rest of the country, so to speak, looks like. And it does not look like Seattle, let me put it that way. And I would beg to say that a majority of the people that in the areas that I've been seeing on this trip would love to be employed by a high paying job. Would love to be in the office if that's what it took. The issue is that that hasn't been the norm, nor has it been something that's been required or asked of by people in these coastal cities, which is, Tucker, to your point, you know, nobody's going to die on that hill. You bring up a good point, Tucker, and that coupled with a 50 basis point drop in interest rates could have a big effect. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, I love this conversation. First of all, Michigan is not a flyover state. I love the Midwest, and the upper Midwest is awesome. It's some of the toughest people because of the worst weather, and they're still the nicest people. It's the coast, you know, and not you in Southern California, guys, but the north, you know, the northern coasts, but really northern east coast. They're just mean. I don't know why they're mean, but they are. But I'm not, so that doesn't matter.
Prison Brian can fit in with anyone, though, so you're ready.
But I love the concept of the inverse correlation around the jobs report. And the reason I don't agree with you, and I don't know if you actually took a position or just asked the question, but the reason I don't think, I think conceptually it makes a lot of sense, but I think you have to look at what is causing a weak jobs report. And that's companies don't want to hire, companies are letting people go. What that really means is that the consumer confidence, corporate confidence, and people's willing to invest and continue this economic growth is at stake. And to me, that is much more powerful than someone saying, I need to go back to work because I might lose my job. If companies aren't growing and investing, I think that has a more of a negative impact than people going, oh no, I need to go see my boss so I don't, you know, I'm not the next on the chopping block. Because if a company's chopping employees because the economy's weak, it doesn't really matter in my mind.
But when companies rehire people after they've made cuts and they've gone through and said, wait a minute, we get less productivity out of these people working from home, then they're not going to offer flexible work hours or remote work. They're going to say, this is a 5-day a week in-person job. And I think over time that has a shift. I think these pullbacks, I didn't take a position earlier. I'm taking a position now. I think that these pullbacks inevitably are bullish for return to work and less flexible work hours. There's no way that they aren't bullish. It's just a question of how much of a positive impact do they have? Does it actually offset the reduction in growth? That's my view. And I think sort of wrapping up this, you know, now 30-minute expose on what's going on in the office market, I mean, I think in many senses, it's as simple as on the capital side, the debt service of these buildings is going to go down. The way in which they're valued is going to cause values to go up, which is going to reduce loan to value, which is going to make it easier for these landlords to refinance without having to contribute either any equity or more likely as much equity as they otherwise would have to keep control of their assets. The office fundamentals in the Class B office market are going to continue to deteriorate because that space is challenging. There's still a ton of leases from COVID era that haven't expired. There's companies doing layoffs, and there's people that are going to take less space when they have the opportunity to do so. And then lastly, the class, you know, A-plus market is going to very likely continue to outperform. There's no new supply coming online. Companies that are in those spaces generally aren't occupying. And in the 12 largest cities in the U.S., we've already seen that market have lower vacancy and higher rents in the last 6 months. And that, I think, and I believe you all agree, is going to continue throughout 2024 and probably beyond.
Yeah, I think the one piece you missed in that summary, and that was done excellent, was the point you made earlier, which I think is the key to all of this, is that on the other side, I think a prolonged weak jobs market and some sort of a downturn to reset on the other side of that. And when we get back to a growth market, you're going to see a very different expectation from companies that have learned, good or bad, about return to office and what their expectations are. And I'm already seeing it. A lot of clients that I'm talking to have already set hiring criteria for their business units that set it at least 3 days a week. You're not going to get approval for this hire unless they're in the office 3 days a week. At companies, that have a very lax policy around working from the office, right? So, or companies that have strong policies too, but it's even happening, I should say, at companies with a lax policy that give existing employees a lot more freedom than employees that they're hiring, which I found very fascinating.
Yeah, and no matter where you stand on the side of the fence of, you know, remote work or working in the office, there was an extreme shift. And I think it's hard to suggest it wasn't extreme to work from home. Okay. And there's going to be a reversion to maybe not the mean, but maybe a new mean that's going to balance this thing out. And that might be accentuated by the jobs report. It may not. But it's going to align better to typical productivity and satisfaction levels amongst the employees. And so it remains to be seen what that mean may be. But we had an extreme shift, and it's certainly not staying there. And I don't think the pendulum is finished swinging back to what might be the new standard.
Agreed. And I would say I think it's brilliant, Tucker, to raise the issue, because what you're talking about is a power shift. Like, who holds the power, the employer or the employee? And it radically moved to the employee side through the pandemic and the work from home. And if the employers could, they would just say, I want people back in the office, but they can't, because that power still is a little bit on the side of the employees. And yes, of course, an increasing decreasing total employment is going to move that fulcrum towards the landlord side. Now the question is how much, and is it material? And but interesting to note and keep in mind that as we see weakening in employment, it will have an impact in shifting some of that power back to the employer side. I think you're exactly right.
So this is why I think this ultimately is great for employees and employers. I remember years ago, one of my most favorite clients, who's extremely talented and knowledgeable in the space, were flying into this remote location for their office, fairly remote. And it's outside of a major city center. It's just under 100,000 feet, right? And this is just what, you know, and the company is a publicly traded, highly professional, very, very, their headquarters is great. It's an awesome company. It's a really awesome company. We get there and they have a main floor, and then the majority of their space is below grade with tiny little windows. And they've got people at desks down there working. And honestly, it's like, this is sad. We need to get these people out of this office. And we made it our mission. We figured out a way to get these people out of there, right? But companies think, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, that was the best space at the time, and it's okay to put our people in subgrade space that was like leaking. It was kind of smelled a little moldy. And there was probably a couple hundred people down there. It was a huge space. And, you know, I think this whole shift, that building should get knocked down, and anything like it should get knocked down, right? And I think this whole shift is educating and at least aligning that the place that people go to work needs to be something that is a good place to go to work. And all these Class B buildings in Midtown South in New York City that are 500 years old, that have windows in the front and the back, and if you're in the middle and you're a new employee, you're basically sitting in the dark with artificial light on your head. That's all you see for 10 hours a day because you're in investment banking. No, like, let's get the people out of those like employee cube farms in the middle of just trash and put them into something nice that they go home and they're happy to live in New York City, right? So I think there's an advantage to this whole thing on the other side that is making companies really understand that people want to work from home because what you've given them has been so bad. It's not their fault. It's your fault.
I love it, Brian. You make the role of the broker, or at least your role in that circumstance, sound more like a hostage rescue.
Yeah, Brian, man of the people, he's always looking out, trying to figure out how he can help everyone improve their lives, not just get them a great real estate outcome, but actually improve the well-being mentally, emotionally, physically of everyone that works at a company. Brian, the heartfelt Brian today, not prison Brian from last week. Brian is on a different leaf today. Okay, changing gears. I have been in three different states over the last couple of days, just this week. I guess four if you count California, where I'm back today after a whirlwind trip. And as we talked about on a recent episode, we've seen factory spend for U.S. manufacturing increase by about 250% compared to what it was in 2019. And when you start thinking about that, and you think about the types of projects that the four of us Corporate Real Estate Insider hosts do. Given that there's 2.5 times more manufacturing projects happening right now, we're generally working on a lot more manufacturing projects. I'd say we're probably working on quite a bit more than 2.5 times more, as they tend to be pretty complicated and require a lot of expertise. And fortunately for us, not many people have those expertise. But where I'm going with this is that every single market that is good for manufacturing is absolutely being hammered with requests for power increases right now. Like, just an insane lead time to increase power output in most areas of the country that are good for manufacturing. And this comes at the same time that, you know, we see, you know, NVIDIA surging and the amount of money on mostly AI-driven chips from, OpenAI and Meta and, Google and all basically these giant technology companies spending hundreds of billions of dollars on chips. There's a lot of information coming out more recently about new companies trying to manufacture chips in a different way that will dramatically increase the power output, specifically for artificial intelligence. A lot of the chips that are being used now, they were originally designed for graphics processing and not designed for AI specifically. What happens if we can decrease the power output required by these data centers to process the everything that they're doing so dramatically? And then all of a sudden, we're like 50% oversupplied on power for the country. Because if you look at percentage of power used in the country on data centers, it's truly wild. When you think about how much power a megawatt is and how many 50-100 megawatt data centers are being built. I'm curious if you all think that this could happen, or if I'm simply being crazy that maybe our power infrastructure is going to be overbuilt if we can figure out how to reduce the power required for, you know, a data center by 50% times the, you know, tons of data centers that are collectively, you know, chewing up like gigabytes upon gigabytes gigawatts of power.
Quick story, just to further what you said about our working on these manufacturing requirements and it relates to power. I've got a requirement currently in the Netherlands, 100,000 square foot clean manufacturing. It turns out that not every building sitting empty today has available power on the grid. And suddenly on the survey, we need to list available power at the building, because if you don't have the power, add 2 years to apply and try and get power to the building in order to run the operation. So to your point, in that example, live power to the building is a key aspect of a building survey.
Yeah, I mean, not just in Europe. I mean, this in the U.S., I mean, if you need to do even a 5 to 10 megawatt upgrade in most parts of the country, you have a 24 to 36 month lead time. And that's not even that much of a power requirement if you're a, 500,000 to a million square foot manufacturer.
Yeah, and the other side of that is, even if what landlords will tell you is, oh, we have 5 megawatts, 2 megawatts, 800 amps, whatever you need, 2000 amps, 480 at the building, and they do have the infrastructure there. But if they haven't been using the power, the building's been sitting vacant, the utility is not just having the power sit at their site not used. It has redeployed that power to another use, right? Because it's a finite resource and they've got to use it. So it's been redeployed. And what you need to do is, it's called a will serve letter. You need to send your utility through your advisors, and not brokers, but usually attorneys. But we help with this process, is you send them a will serve letter. And in most states, there's a contractual requirement to actually provide you the power that they once provided that facility. But it doesn't mean they have to do it overnight. So if your timeline is aggressive to be up and running, and a lot of these manufacturing requirements, they are chasing a market, they're chasing demand, especially on the chip side. Like, I've done fabs where they're every day that they're not building chips, they're losing tens of millions of dollars, right? It's a chase to meet demand in the marketplace. And then you send this letter and they respond, yep, we got your letter and you're right, we're required to provide this, and the timeline is 18 months, right? It's like, boom. So it's every building isn't the same, and everybody wants to be an industrial broker right now, and they all want to serve this marketplace. I will tell you, there's a company I'm talking to right now that it might be out of business because they screwed this up so bad and the building they took doesn't meet their requirement. And they signed a real long-term lease, and it's really sad because they were advised poorly by somebody who's never done one of these deals before. And it's a shell, and the shell works great, but none of the infrastructure meets their requirements, and they can't get power to the building.
I'm gonna go on the fence and say that we're not gonna have an abundance of power, like an oversupply, if data centers and the likes find ways to use power more efficiently, for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, we have other growing factors and industries within our economy that require more and more power every day. And let's not forget the Fed's initiative to kind of have us all be driving electric cars in a few years. So there's even a greater demand on the grid, just powering all these cars that I don't yet drive, but maybe I will soon. So I think there are enough uses that will absorb any excess power that flows to the grid. But also, I've got clients that are in the energy storage business, and they have technology that allows them, when there is a surplus of power, to store that power through batteries and other means for uses, or for later uses when there is a surge of demand. But I think also, finally, I think this could lead to a transition of where we get our energy from, and make us more reliant on renewable energy versus fossil fuels that is still powering a majority of our grid. And so to suggest that there could be an oversupply if there's people using power more efficiently, certainly could be. But I think, again, just like I promise not to go back to office space, but just like there could be a reversion to the mean in terms of how many work from home versus work in the office, there could be a reversion to the mean after there's an abundance of power to kind of balance out the grid and that power which is available.
I think it's important to note that there's sort of two issues here, right? There is the power generation problem and storage problem, and then there's the power distribution problem. And a lot of times these power upgrades have to do with distribution, right? It's about getting a substation close enough that they can run a feeder to your property. And then also, obviously, the switchgear and transformers that go actually in your building to step the power up or down or whatever needs to happen to meet whatever your specific utility needs are. So there's two issues, and I want to make sure that we don't confuse them because we're sort of talking about both. I mean, one, the power distribution issue is going to continue to be an issue for any large manufacturer, short of someone having just been there, having a will serve letter from the utility company, having them have kept that capacity and guarantee that you're going to have it. But on the power generation side, which is a completely different story, if it is possible that all of a sudden data centers become 50% more efficient, this same thing happened with cooling over the last 10, 20 years. If you look at a data center from 20 years ago, it is functionally obsolete. The amount of cooling in these buildings was insane, like absolutely insane. And you don't need that level of cooling anymore. And the cooling systems have totally changed from air to primarily being liquid cooled. So I'm not convinced that we're going to have a massive overabundance of power. If we did, gosh, that'd be amazing, right? Like that's one of the highest correlated things to GDP is like power generation, right? So I don't think that that's going to happen, but it had me, you know, starting to think with everyone rushing to increase power generation, increase distribution, is there any way that this could be fixed by just more efficient chips? So I'm glad people are working on those. We'll see.
I think your comment is spot on, Tucker. Is if you listen to CNBC religiously like I do, I think every day there's a conversation on energy capacity to meet growing demand. And every investor that they bring on is talking about the growth in data centers, the growth in AI, the growth in consumption. What everybody's missing, and this is, I think, the reason, this is like the conversation when your dentist is a real estate investor, it's time to sell everything you have. When, Wall Street is telling you that we've got a power problem, it's time to, take the inverse position. And I think, I was listening to another podcast about this because I have the same premise. the average age of our storage hardware inside data centers is 7 years. If they were to upgrade to current technology today, and it's a capital intensive project, but power is very expensive. If they were to upgrade to current flash technology today, doesn't mean that's tomorrow's generation or 2 years from now, it would reduce the energy needs of that by 80%. So it's the American way, right? There's massive amounts of investments trying to look at both sides of the equation. All everyone is talking about is increases in consumption. They're not talking about all the technology that's coming out to make things more efficient. Same example with your data center from 20 years ago. There's two reasons that the HVAC equipment is not using as much power. One is it's more efficient and they've found ways to make it better, which is kind of what's happening too on the data center side. The second is they don't need as much of it because the heat discharge out of the hardware, because there's less hardware, because they can store more on less devices. So there's less hardware in there. There's less backup batteries. There's just less heat generation. So you need less HVAC. So it's not just what we're trying to look at, and everyone's kind of focused on the left hand when the right hand's still trying to get better and make everything more efficient and use less power. So I think right now our power growth, the last number I saw, is like 3% more demand year over year, which is the highest growth, you know, since the Industrial Revolution or something like that. The mean is kind of 0%, 1%. It kind of is steady Eddie, and demand has been pretty flat for many, many years. I think we're going to see it come back down significantly because the marketplace will catch up and be able to help offset some of the increase in uses with efficiencies in existing technology or upgrades to existing technology. That's my premise on it. And by the way, and I know some of you are also working with, there's new technologies coming out on the generation side. I think, Tech, your point on distribution, completely screwed. Our distribution network around the country, like you get out of the major cities and even in the major cities, but you get like one step outside. They can't even put charging stations in. That's the reason that we have this federal bill to put charging stations and they haven't been able to do it because there's no infrastructure. It's not about the charging station. It's about getting power to the charging station along the highways and none of it exists. So you can't put a charger at the gas station because there's not enough power at the gas station to run it. And so, like, the distribution network is really bad, and that's where all the cost really comes from. The energy companies will give your factory, if you're in a requirement, they would love to supply you with the power. And right now, in most markets, they have the generation to do it. I would say it's a broad brush, but most markets do. It's the distribution where all the cost is and where all the timeline is, because some of it's got to go underground. You got to go onto the poles. I was looking at a project. They're like, yeah, we'll run it on the poles. They go do a field survey. Oh, the poles are full. We'd have to replace every telephone pole for 4 miles from the substation. Okay, our project went from 24 months to 48 months. Right? It's just like, oh, what? Okay, that building's off the list. That city might be off the list in a project, right? So it's our grid is really the issue. I think generation with these micro reactors, with changing in technology for solar, for wind, whatever it is, like everything's just getting so much better so quickly that the generation side, I think we're going to be fine. It's distribution where people aren't talking about it enough.
Well, and when you refer to the grid, for those that, you know, don't understand how the grid works, and I'm by no means an expert, but there is an Eastern, a Western, and a Texas grid, and they're not all interconnected. So sharing power amongst those three grids, which make up the United States grid, is not as easy as you think. So in other words, like the Eastern grid has a surplus, like we've talked about potentially happening with data centers using less power. They can't just flip a switch and send it over to Seattle or LA. It's not that easy. And it's not as interconnected as, say, Europe is. So anyway, this is a larger problem and requires further investment to build resilience. And we don't need to get into that because that could... We're not experts on power grids.
No, but it goes to show you like just how inefficient the system is. If you remember, Texas had all those ice storms and like people were out without power. There was a lot of deaths, unfortunately. Like it was catastrophic for some locations in Texas. and everyone else in the country is sitting there with plenty of power. It's like, and that's when I started to hear about like how just archaic our grids are. They are, they can be completely separate between different areas of the country and they can't help each other out. So it's a long ways and it's a lot of work to get there and a lot of capital.
Quick anecdote from where I live, San Diego Gas and Electric, one of the most expensive utilities in the country, and acknowledges that they're making less and less money from generation. So the business of the utility is becoming about distribution. It's becoming about the, and so it's no surprise that the renewable projects that seem to be moving forward are large scale solar, for example, in the desert, where now San Diego Gas and Electric has to spend $4 billion building the infrastructure to bring the power to the city. Is that the best approach? I'm not sure, but isn't it interesting that that's where they make their money now? And suddenly the renewable that we see going in is going in a long way away, and they have to pay to build the, and they make money building the infrastructure to bring it into the city center.
And I'll add, if you want to learn about power grids and entertain yourself at the same time, there's a good book written by Ted Koppel. And for those that are my age or older, you might remember him as the ABC News commentator. It's called Lights Out. He published it 9 years ago. It's on Amazon. But it's what would happen to our nation if we were attacked by a cyber attack on our power grid and the lack of interconnectivity, what that could do to our country. So it's a little bit of almost sci-fi thriller, if you will. I wouldn't say it's sci-fi, but it goes into detail about the grid. And if you care to know more, it's a fun way to learn about it.
Yeah, back, I want to say it was like 2013, I worked on a project. It was called C-Link. It was a project for NextEra Energy, which is owned by Florida Power and Light. And the whole premise was it to bring 1,000 megawatts of power from the Seabrook Nuclear Power Station in Seabrook, New Hampshire, down into the grid in Boston, because ISO New England had done a study and realized that our grid didn't have enough generation. And their contingency plans during a very cold spell in the winter, which uses a lot of power, obviously everyone's heating their homes, and all the office buildings and such, the contingency plan was to float diesel generators into Boston Harbor to meet demand for power. So the state, working through ISO New England, came up with an RFP, and this power now is sitting at Seabrook and it's underutilized, right? The state elected to go with a different plan that went over, and this was going to go in the ocean, come into Boston, C-Link from Seabrook and into Boston. And they elected to go with a plan overhead through Western New England coming out of Canada. And the project is about 500 miles from Boston. They can't get through all of the lawsuits from the various cities and towns to get it into the city. So that was 10 years ago. And you just, distribution's the problem, because the United States, it's private landowners, right? It's just every city and town has a say. It is a lot of work and it is decades to move massive amounts of power through each communities and across state lines, right? And I tell the story because it just goes to show you how hard it is to have meaningful change in our distribution on a wide scale that, you know, that helps these cities and towns because of the way that the U.S. is set up.
Okay, let's wrap up there. That's episode 43. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Got some, you know, power talk in, got some interest rate talk in, talked about the space market. What else could you ask for? Thanks, and we'll see you next time.